Good afternoon. It's Mountain Edition. I'm Carolyn Zachariasen.
And I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. The city of Aspen looks at land in Woody Creek as a possible option for water storage.
The principal of a new school in Glenwood Springs tells us what it means to be centered on project-based learning.
One local nonprofit supports Valley residents battling cancer while trying to keep a low profile.
And we talk with a scientist who is one of the first ever to say climate change is caused by humans.
Those stories and more coming up on Mountain Edition.
Starting next week, travelers looking to fly between Denver and Aspen can use an app to book a seat on a chartered plane. Allison Bechtesh reports.
Blackbird CEO Rudd Davis calls his app an alternative to I-70 traffic for a lower price than flying the route on commercial airlines. Users book a space on a charter jet managed by Blackbird. Because bigger planes come at a lower price point, the higher the demand, the lower the ticket cost becomes.
Aviation is a completely different animal. You know, as people begin to use the product, it really is going to get down into a price point that is consistently comparable to renting a car.
Davis launched the app in California earlier this year. It's been so popular that flights between Palo Alto and Lake Tahoe are now down to $120. Beginning flights between Aspen and Denver are estimated to be $400. Because flights booked on Blackbird go through private terminals, passengers are not required to go through TSA screenings and may arrive just 15 minutes before takeoff. Allison Bechtesh, Aspen Public Radio News.
Colorado lawmakers want to improve how public schools integrate digital learning in and outside of the classroom. A report recently released highlights priorities and says combining technology with traditional teaching improves test scores and engages students. Benta Berkland has more from the state capitol.
The term is called blended learning. It's a combination of in-person instruction and online learning. Judy Perez is the founder of the iLearn Collaborative. She says she created the effort 4 years ago after her sons needed to be more challenged in school.
We're talking about leveraging technology for instructional practice. That's almost foreign to most teachers that we work with. It's more than just using an app or accessing a website when I'm home doing my homework.
The top priority for the state to fully implement the program is training teachers on how to get the most out of technology to help students. Another hurdle is making sure students have laptops and iPads they can bring home. The report also says close to 400,000 students don't have enough internet access to participate. I'm Benta Berkland at the state capitol.
The Grand Avenue Bridge in Glenwood Springs is the main gateway to the Roaring Fork Valley. It's closing in less than 2 weeks. It'll be closed for 95 days as the new bridge is completed. In the meantime, traffic will be rerouted onto a two-lane detour. To learn about how some businesses are preparing for the closure, producer Kristen Kay sat down with Wyatt Orm, our reporter based in Carbondale.
Obviously, we're all going to be impacted by this, but let's focus on local businesses.
Yeah, it seems like construction companies disproportionately are going to be affected by the closure. And not all construction companies will be impacted the same. There's some really, really big companies out of Grand Junction or Denver that already have employee housing set up, so they don't have employees who live west of the bridge. There are other smaller, maybe more local construction companies who do have employees who live on the other side of the bridge, and they have to get their employees to and from work every single day.
So what are some ways that local businesses are altering their order of operations because of this closure?
So the city of Glenwood Springs is changing up their work week. Staff there is going to work 10-hour days four times a week. And this 10-hour day just basically ensures that they're not kind of commuting in the thick of the traffic on the detour. Carbondale is going to do basically the same thing, but other companies aren't really changing all that much. The ski company, for example, the Aspen Ski Company, told me they're just educating their employees about the impacts of the bridge closure. The closure for the ski company is happening at kind of the least painful time that it could.
How are hotels in the valley going to be affected?
Some of the hotels that I've talked to seem like they're most concerned about their deliveries. So making sure that the food they've ordered is getting here on time, the bars of soap and so forth.
So speaking of deliveries, how about grocery stores? Will there be a fresh apple in sight in the valley?
There definitely will. There definitely will. There's no need to start stocking up on canned foods. Kroger, who runs City Market, says that they've already been delivering in the middle of the night because the traffic is so bad.
So are local businesses just gearing up to lose money because of this?
Not everyone. I had an interesting conversation with someone who works in sales at the Element Hotel in Basalt. And she told me that the bridge closure actually is a good thing for their business because she's gotten a lot of calls from construction companies who are asking about long-term stays. Also, during October and November, there are going to be more commercial flights into Aspen. Both United and American Airlines are adding an additional nonstop flight. At the end of the day, we don't really know what the bridge closure is going to do, so we kind of have to wait and see.
The Quality of Life Fund has just celebrated its 10th year. In that time, the local nonprofit has doled out more than $1 million in grants for Valley residents battling cancer. As Allison Bektesh reports, the effort operates under the radar, but it has an over-the-top impact for its beneficiaries.
Barbara and Bruce Berger are the charming kind of couple you can tell have been together forever.
Do you want to start, Barbara?
You start.
11 years ago,
an employee of theirs was diagnosed with cancer. She couldn't work during treatment, and the Bergers started helping by paying some of her bills.
And she unfortunately passed away. And when she passed away, Barbara and I realized that if she was having these problems, there had to be other people in the Valley who were facing the same kind of difficulty.
So the couple began the Quality of Life Fund, providing grants to cancer patients to help with the soft costs that come with having the disease. Money is raised through an annual dinner that Barbara plans and Bruce cooks. Soft cost means everything outside of healthcare expenses. The bills that are due even though you're in a hospital bed, vomiting after chemotherapy, or undergoing surgery to remove a mass.
Like the day that you get diagnosed, you're like, can I do this?
Maria Peterson is one of more than 400 recipients of the grant. In 2016, a routine mammogram showed lesions, which can indicate breast cancer.
And you know, 1 minute you're like scared to death because you don't think you can change or you can't do it. The next minute, you're like, I can do it. I'm going to have to figure it out.
She lives in the Valley with her husband and son. They never thought they'd be asking for charity. Peterson is a private chef. She had to cancel a lucrative list of summer clients while undergoing a double mastectomy and chemotherapy. She had health insurance through her husband's job, but no way to pay the rest of their bills.
Everyone's like, you guys need to move out of the Valley, you know, because why would you live here? This is so expensive.
But the Bergers don't believe a cancer diagnosis should mean moving away from your home and your community. In the decades since the fund began, they have helped with rent, cell phone bills, school supplies so patients' children don't have to go to class without a notebook, and they've had to pay for funerals. Barbara knows life's routine errands can become insurmountable to those fighting for their life.
It's hard to believe in this community that there are people who can't afford the gas to go to treatment or can't afford a babysitter. Or a funeral. Hard to believe it, but you would not imagine the amount of people in that situation. It's shocking.
Bill Graves is another recipient of the Quality of Life Fund. A private contractor, he found himself with nowhere to turn when diagnosed with throat cancer.
You know, typical of a self-employed person in this valley. You've got enough money to make rent, buy some groceries, and that's about it. Within the first, I'd say 2 weeks, you know, my savings was gone.
Graves got to the Valley in 1976. As with all locals, he knows a lot of people. But cancer is personal.
I didn't want to involve everybody. You know, I felt this was my battle. I'm going to go through it.
Graves felt he'd be a burden if he turned to his friends to ask for help. What he learned through the Quality of Life Fund is there's strangers out there more than happy to chip in for a neighbor.
I don't know if there's another area in the country that really the community helps. It's people that are suffering. As you can see, it meant a lot to me.
Community is what comes first for the Bergers, too. Barbara herself was diagnosed with cancer 31 years ago. She says she's grateful she had the family support and financial resources to get through treatment and believes everyone deserves that quality of life.
The simple things are the things we provide, but they're the most important.
Allison Bektesh, Aspen Public Radio News.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Carolyn Zachariasen. Stay in the know with what's happened in the Roaring Fork Valley and beyond through our social media channels. Follow Aspen Pub Radio on Twitter, follow us on Instagram, and like us on Facebook for news, updates, compelling images, and intriguing stories. Aspen Public Radio, your news, your music, your station. The Carbondale Board of Trustees is considering a new Bill of Rights for the environment.
Trustee Frosty Marriott says Carbondale has a long history of strong environmental policy. There's a fee on plastic bags, a green building code, and a climate action plan. But still, he says, the town needs to define a clear mission on environmental topics.
We believe in having clean air, clean water, access to the night sky, view of the night sky, and to protect our native wildlife.
And to make that official, Marriott has been heading up work on an environmental bill of rights that will serve as a guiding document for future boards of trustees. Marriott and fellow trustee Heather Henry presented a draft to the board last week. A streamlined version is expected next month.
The Eagle County Regional Airport in Gypsum will see an increase in the number of flights this coming ski season. Wyatt Orm has the story.
The holiday period extends roughly from mid-December to mid-January. During this time, American Airlines is adding a second daily flight from Chicago. It's also expanding its daily flights from Phoenix until April. United Airlines will also offer weekend flights to and from Chicago until April. Flights from Salt Lake City are also returning during the holiday period. Delta will offer a daily flight with 69 seats. This is the first time this flight has been offered since the 1994-95 winter season. And in Aspen, both United and American Airlines added a flight for this fall to Sardi Field. Wyatt Orm, Aspen Public Radio News.
Over 20 years ago, Dr. Ben Santer was part of the team of international scientists who first published work showing climate change can be attributed to human influence. Santer discussed his work with Elizabeth while he was in Aspen earlier this week.
So you're here in Aspen talking about the sentence that changed science. What is that sentence?
12 words that are forever imprinted on my memory. Quote, "The balance of evidence suggests a discernible human influence on global climate," unquote. Those are the words of the international scientific community. So back in 1995, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, came out with its second assessment report of climate science. And that was the bottom line sentence from that report: "The balance of evidence suggests a discernible human influence on global climate."
Okay, now, why were these words so powerful? Why are they still so powerful?
It was really the first time that the international scientific community spoke with one voice and said, we've evaluated the scientific evidence, and most of that evidence is pointing in one direction. Humans are no longer innocent bystanders in the climate system. Humans and their activities are now active participants in the climate system.
In the time since that sentence has come out, and you've seen some real considerable pushback, your role has become also to effectively communicate how this change is happening, is to break down all those complex systems and make it understandable for the general public. So is it the scientist's role to become a storyteller? Is it the scientist's role to become an effective communicator?
After the balance of evidence statement came out in 1995, my life changed. Mm-hmm. Like it or not, I was the convening lead author of the chapter of the report that had this finding in it. I carried the can. The buck stopped here. And I had to explain to people what the process was by which we had arrived at that balance of evidence finding, what the evidence was that underpinned that finding, what I had done, what my role had been. I recognized that I could no longer just retreat to my office, close the door, and hope the bad stuff would go away. That was a singularly poor survival strategy. I had to explain to people in plain English what we had learned in the process of working on this report and why it mattered to them. And since 1995, I've taken that responsibility very seriously. I don't think that we can shift the needle in terms of arriving at solutions to the problem of human-caused climate change just by piling on more scientific papers. There's also an urgent need to be accountable to the public, to explain this is what we did, this is what we learned, and this is why it matters to you. And I would argue that that imperative to explain to the public what we do and what we've learned is particularly important at this time when very powerful people at the highest levels of government are dismissing all of this hard-fought, hard-won scientific understanding as a hoax, as a conspiracy, as a contrived phony mess. It isn't. The science is incredibly sound. It's been tested again and again and again. If you're a climate scientist, that's what you do. You know, you kick the tires. You try and understand as best as you can these complex forces acting on the climate system, human and natural. And our best understanding is that humans are now a dominant force in the climate system and are responsible for most of the warming that we've seen and measured since the mid-20th century. And we ignore this problem at our peril. So part of the challenge is to push back against ignorance and push back against misrepresentation of scientific understanding.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for your questions.
That was Dr. Ben Santer. He's a climate scientist and in 1995 was part of the team that published work showing climate change can be attributed to human influence.
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. If you missed the first part of today's show, you can find a podcast on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. While you're browsing our site, make sure to sign up for ForkFed, our weekly digital newsletter. ForkFed arrives in your inbox every Friday, catching you up on the week's news in a fun and informative way.
Pitkin County Sheriff Joe DeSalvo has lifted the countywide fire ban.
After 1 month of restrictions, local fire chiefs now say that the danger is waning. A few weeks of July showers have brought the fuel moisture level in the county back to near normal levels. Rick Ballantyne is Aspen Fire Chief. He says this doesn't necessarily mean we're out of the woods.
If the weather pattern goes back to very dry and very hot and very windy, the amount of fuel that has been built up during the wet season, there's quite a bit of grass and other vegetation has grown up. If that goes dry, it just becomes ladder fuels for bigger fires.
Restrictions on White River National Forest land will lift on Friday, and officials with the Bureau of Land Management said they plan on the same timeline for the Colorado River Valley.
The arts campus at Willett's Interim Space opens this weekend, kicking off with a concert on Sunday. Claire Woodcock visited the temporary while under construction and brings us this report.
The Temporary is this up-and-coming hub for music, comedy, cinema, and lectures. Think performing hall meets nightclub. TACAW's managing director Ryan Honey says this is huge for arts both in Basalt and the Mid-Valley.
I just feel like a performance venue where great acts from all over the country can come is past due.
In the fall, the nonprofit wants to introduce a form of kids programming to provide opportunities to young people interested in what makes the theater tick. The new venue is located in a warehouse in Willits. Over a handful of shows have already been announced, with Canadian singer-songwriter Jessica Alossery on Sunday. Claire Woodcock, Ed Lisneason Arts and Culture Desk.
The Roaring Fork and Colorado Rivers meet smack dab in downtown Glenwood Springs. The city wants to revitalize the area. Tonight, elected officials will decide whether to hire a consultant to come up with a plan. Wyatt Orm has the details.
If hired, the firm Stromberg Garrigan Associates will come up with a plan to redevelop the area around the confluence. Glenwood Springs received a grant from the EPA in January for just this purpose. The confluence area is home to a former sewer plant and a CDOT maintenance facility, among other things. The plan will involve housing and community space. Wyatt Orm, Aspen Public Radio News.
Last month, the city of Aspen announced plans to buy about 60 acres of land in Woody Creek that would be used for a reservoir in the future. It's part of the city's work to explore options other than using water rights to build reservoirs on Castle and Maroon Creeks. Environment reporter Elizabeth Stewart-Severy has been reporting on the issue.
Elizabeth, the city of Aspen is in state water court trying to keep those rights on Castle and Maroon Creeks. Explain how this purchase would affect that.
Okay, so the plan is to move those rights, and Aspen City Manager Steve Barwick was pretty clear in a press conference that there are no plans to give up the conditional rights the city currently owns.
There would not be any abandoning of water rights. We would be moving the water rights from one site to another.
And that would obviously need to be discussed in water court. The court would have to allow the shift, and it could be part of a settlement with the 10 parties that are opposing the city of Aspen over those rights on Castle and Maroon.
So this basically just shifts the storage spot downriver. What are these opposing parties saying about that move?
Well, the feedback that I've heard so far has been really positive. Two environmental organizations, Wilderness Workshop and Western Resource Advocates, both released statements that really praise the city for the attempt to move those rights. I talked with Rob Harris, who's an attorney with Western Resource Advocates, and here's what he had to say.
You know, we're encouraged. This isn't a done deal yet. There are a lot of steps along the way, but we think that this is a step that's absolutely in the right direction towards permanently protecting Maroon and Castle Creeks.
Okay, so this addresses the challenges from several of the parties, including the Forest Service. The Forest Service opposition is based on the fact that the current rights would flood wilderness areas, and that would no longer be an issue if those rights are moved to Woody Creek. Some of the other opposition is from people who live in those valleys, and it doesn't seem likely that they would object to those rights moving to Woody Creek.
Okay, I can't help but notice, but Woody Creek is downriver from Aspen, mm-hmm. where the water would presumably be used. Does that mean the city would be pumping water back uphill from a reservoir in that location?
So that's not totally clear yet. Steve Barwick says the city would really like eventually to find a way to use a gravity-fed system. This kind of downstream storage is actually quite common on the Front Range, and it does give some flexibility in managing water during times of drought. Here's Barwick at the press conference last month.
And you may not need to use this exact water. You may be able to exchange it for other water that's closer to our current water treatment plant.
So there would be diversion structures upriver that the city would be managing, and there could be options for the city to potentially borrow rights from someone upstream and then use the reservoir as a means to add water back to the river later.
Okay, and how much water are we talking about? Is it the same amount of storage?
Well, that's not clear yet. The current rights allow the city to store close to 15,000 acre feet of water between the two reservoir options, and the city is now studying how much water it might need in the future. This has been the subject of several council work sessions, and there are two consultants working on different pieces of that question of how much water could be stored. So George Omek is an agricultural economist. He's using complex modeling systems to study Aspen's supply and demand for water in the future. And he's looking at several different scenarios. In all of those scenarios, climate change plays a huge role, and there's some real uncertainty there in how much climate change actually will affect water supply and demand. At the same time, there are geological studies underway that will show what kind of capacity might be possible at several sites. And the first spot they'll study in depth is this property in Woody Creek.
And when can we see some resolution or progress on this?
Well, the filing to keep the rights on Castle and Maroon Creeks is kind of winding its way through water court. And this is likely to be proposed as a part of a settlement. The whole process will take years because there are a lot of moving parts. Everything from geological studies, litigation, real estate, engineering. And then it's also not clear when Aspen might actually need to start storing water.
To hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast, The Dial. Go to aspenpublicradio.org and under the Your News tab, click on The Dial.
Adam Volek is the principal of Riverview School. That's the new school outside of Glenwood Springs that opens in September. It's K through 8. It was created to address overcrowding at neighboring schools. Wyatt Orm sat down with Volek to discuss the goals of the school and what it's taken to get it up and running.
Dual language, project-based learning. What does that mean?
Project-based learning provides an opportunity for kids to really go deep in their learning.
What would an example be?
Our PE teacher is really excited about building a pump track.
And what is that? What's a pump track?
The track that kids can ride their bikes on. And so really a project maybe for our, let's say, eighth grade PE class is to design the whole project, to do the research on the project, maybe have consultation from groups that have built pump tracks in the past, and then to actually build the pump track itself. There's mathematics involved in that. There's measurement involved in that.
A student who goes to Riverview School from kindergarten till eighth grade, when they graduate, what will they be able to do ideally?
Mm-hmm. The goal is that students leave the school bilingual and biliterate in both Spanish and English.
Why is it important to learn both languages?
Just from, you know, a standpoint of being able to get a job. If you're bilingual, you know, that's pretty substantial, and it's the reality of where we live.
Do you have a full roster of teachers for this upcoming school year?
We do.
Okay. And how many teachers are there?
Off the top of my head, I think we are at about 27 teachers.
How many were hired from within the district and how many from outside?
overall, our staff is, you know, comprised of a diverse representation of background and experience. And, you know, the majority of our staff come from the Valley.
This has been a contentious issue with the opening up of the new school, is that there are teachers who were displaced. How much did that factor into your hiring?
Well, I think what we're really lucky to have in the district is just a very talented group of educators. And no matter what school you're going to, here in the Roaring Fork School District, you have great, great teachers that are going to be working with our amazing children.
Adam Volek, thanks so much for speaking with me.
Absolutely.
Adam Volek is the principal of Riverview School. Wyatt Orm, Aspen Public Radio News.
Artist Lawrence Wiener is known as a central figure in the origin of conceptual art in the 1960s. He is this year's recipient of the Aspen Award for Art through the Aspen Art Museum. Claire Woodcock caught up with him at the museum before Friday's Art Crush Gala.
So, looking back at decades of work that you've produced, what do you see in that work now that maybe wasn't so clear to you before?
Let's just say that it successfully entered the culture, and it was of some use to some people.
Well, when you see your artwork in public, how does it make you feel now?
The same as it did when it first went up. If I thought I did a good job, very proud, and if I thought it would bring about somebody walking along, giving more dignity to the stones they're walking on, I'll be a happy camper.
How does it feel to be recognized in Aspen this week for the award that will be presented to you at Art Crush on Friday?
I like getting awards. No, I'm very serious, and I'm one of those people that tries. I don't teach, but when I find myself with younger people, try to explain that if you think you've done something well, there's nothing wrong with saying, wow, it's not egocentric, it's just about, and you move on from then. So that's how I feel.
Looking back on your storied career, what does this award mean to you?
It means that a lot of people didn't mind public artists. There comes things that nobody thought would ever happen, and you do them. And people say that's not right or it is right. But in fact, if you watch that, it worked out okay.
How do you think that art can benefit society today?
By presenting a logic system that transposes from the person's private life. And if it doesn't have a morals and kind of holding things together, it's very useful for people to be able to understand their place in the sun, where they are. You have to do that, and nobody ever is embarrassed to say, I'm trying to find out where I fit in. But art allows you to, because you can relate it to objects. And in relating it to objects and sulfur and this and that, It functions. That's what I think it's about. Not anything else. The fact that something meant something to you, that's like the poem that you remember when you were a child, the song that you won't forget, and the drawing that you had in your bedroom. That's what art is supposed to be. It becomes a souvenir of something that allowed you to figure out who you were in the world that you found yourself in.
That was artist Lawrence Wiener reflecting on a career's worth of art he's brought into the world. I'm Claire Woodcock at the Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk.
That's all for this week's Mountain Edition. I'm Carolyn Zachariasen.
And I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. To hear this show again or subscribe to our Mountain Edition podcast, head to our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Tune in tomorrow at 3:30 for Valley Roundup. I talk with a panel of local journalists about the week's news.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.